It's the Mark Stein Show. And now, here's Mark.
Hey, welcome along. We are in the beautiful Bahamas on the Mark Stein Cruise with an audience of Mark Stein Cruisers from the United States and from a fair few of His Majesty's dominions across the planet. I think we even have a couple of sinister Europeans here as well. Lurking around. Last night on the cruise, someone came up to me and said, Stein, why aren't you on Fox News anymore? And I said that I was invited on. The last time I was on, I was invited on to talk about Andrew Cuomo's dog. And I thought about, 45 seconds into it, life is too short to be talking about Andrew Cuomo's dog. There are huge things going on that we should talk more about and that we don't talk more about. And one of the biggest, I would say, all left-wing plans are big. They're ambitious. And the right-wing response tends to be weak. And as you know, there's a lot of people, there's people who are supposedly, they're fiscally conservative but socially liberal. There used to be a whole generation of governors who fitted into that. Christie Whitman, Arnold Schwarzenegger, George Pataki, William Weld in Massachusetts, and this was thought to be the sweet spot to be. It's not the sweet spot to be, in part because the fiscal conservatism always loses to the social liberalism because the social liberalism tends to be bloody expensive. And it seems to me we are actually in a hugely important moment in human history where the left has almost completed its demolition of the basic... The most important interest group in society is the citizen. The citizen equal before the law. And if you don't have citizens equal before the law, and if instead you have a hierarchy of victimology, which is what we have now, you are basically undermining the pillars of society. So that we're not going to talk about whatever the Republican caucus wants to talk about it, you know, 2% cut in capital gains tax or whatever. We're going to be talking about some of the big things on this cruise. So I've got an excellent panel, and I hope you'll enjoy them. They may appear to be somewhat Britannic in their mien, but in fact, two of them are additionally U.S. citizens. So if you can spot the one who isn't a U.S. citizen, we've got a fully loaded Tesla that we'll be giving away. It's got a long cord, so you can just drop it off the back of the ship and it'll tow you to Jamaica. And it's the new model Tesla, so it doesn't burst into flames for the first 60 miles. It's guaranteed that. Anyway, my first guest, Leilani Dowding, is a former Miss Great Britain. And that was, by the way, back in the days when they let biological women win beauty contests. So it was way more competitive than it is now. And she was also a former Page Three girl in The Sun, which is Rupert Murdoch's great contribution to journalism. And we certainly thank him for it. And since then, she's become... she's one of my favorite commentators. She's incredibly prescient. It doesn't matter whether it's COVID, it doesn't matter whether it's Ukraine. I've learned the hard way that if you have a difference of opinion with Leilani, you wait 3-6 months and it turns out Leilani was right all along. Will you please welcome Leilani Dowding? Mm. And next we have I always say Canadian rock royalty, because his dad and his uncles were big rockers, and Tal is a big rocker too. And he knows I'm Mr. Squaresville, and I don't dig a lot of the rock and roll. And he's very kind. He's very kind. Every Christmas Eve, he does one of my favorite Christmas carols. And he does them as bossa novas and all kinds of interesting things. So we may get him to do We Three Kings of Orient Are as a calypso when we land in Jamaica, just for the hell of it. Will you please welcome Tal Bachman? And third, I don't know how many of you have met this young lady. She is part of one of the most terrible stories of the last 30 years or so in England, where almost every town of any size has been hollowed out by an epidemic of absolutely horrendous child sexual abuse. And she is from Telford in Shropshire, which is one of the worst towns for that. And we had her on basically because to tell her story, and because she was a victim. And so she came on the show. And the next night, the next morning, she was at home in Telford, and the dirty, stinking, rotten, corrupt West Mercia Constabulary, who allowed all the terrible things that have happened in that town to happen, came banging on her door and demanding to know why she was talking smack about them on my television show. And so the first thing Samantha did was get in touch with her. So she came back on again and rammed it down the gullet of the dirty, stinking, rotten, corrupt West Mercia Constabulary. And I realized then that she's not a victim at all. She's actually one of the bravest and strongest people I've ever met. And we made her a regular so that instead of not talking about all the crummy stuff in her life, she was actually talking about all kinds of other things as well. As I said, she's one of the toughest and most indomitable spirits I know. Will you welcome Samantha Smith? It's very weird to me. I think we are seeing the emergence of identity groups that it's very Leninist, I think, when people talk about, you know, in the Soviet Union, it was a basic whom dichotomy. Once any issue came up, once you knew who was on one side and once you knew who was on the other, you knew who was going to win and who wasn't. And that's the world we're in today. I guess, Leilani, the most obvious one right at the moment, because it's one that all the right laughed about 10 years ago, and it's the one that candidates like Nikki Haley don't really want to go anywhere near and give terrible answers when they do. And that's this whole transgender thing that has kind of, it was a boutique niche thing, just, you know, as drag acts and showgirls and what have you, and now it's everywhere.
And when I was living in Los Angeles, I saw it quite a lot. And as I went back to England, I was trying to explain it to my friends and family and other people. And they kind of just brushed it off because it hadn't come over yet. Right. And I think what happened a lot was the right ignore cultural issues and social issues, and they ignore entertainment and TV and music. And during the lockdowns, a lot of kids didn't go and play their sports. They didn't play, you know, go swimming, do karate, go to the gym, mix with their friends. They were stuck on their phones and watching people like Dylan Mulvaney, like Jeffrey Marsh, get all this attention. by playing victim, but also pretending to be girls, not right. even women, girls, which was so creepy, talking about feminine products like tampons from these males. I mean, it was really scary. And they saw the attention these people were getting, and it became almost like a social contagion. Yeah. And so I think a lot of people think, well, you know, if a man wants to dress as a woman or do that, as long as I don't have to play into the delusion and say, okay, this man is a female and call them by the pronouns, then that's one thing. But now it's like we're all expected to buy into it. We're expected at work, you know, to say these men are female. And then they start on the children. And right. that's, you know, that is a line that people need to draw. And you know, I was speaking to a psychologist, and she said her board is the only people that stand against it in the whole of America, right. because they're allowing children now to transition and get put on puberty blockers, which is basically chemical castration.
Right.
So then, even worse, I watched Matt Walsh the other day talking about a transgender woman, biological male, who now wants to breastfeed. So he's been given hormones to produce these secretions and then attaches the baby to it right. and said that he got turned on slightly by it, but not to judge him.
Yeah, and yeah. this is... So, and what's fascinated me about this, Leonardi, is that you would think that it's a guy who has a fetish where he wants to breastfeed, and then you would think the baby's rights trump that. But in fact, which it would have done until fairly recently. I mean, when my kids were young, if New Hampshire Social Services had shown up and I had one of my kids, I was breastfeeding one of my kids, I'd never have seen that kid again. No. And that was just 10 or 20 years ago. Whereas now, all the professional bodies say that, oh, this is a perfectly healthy thing.
Yes, the NHS, you know, came out and said it's fine and it's almost comparable. Now, breastfeeding women, they don't drink before they breastfeed a lot of the time. You know, there's certain drugs they won't take. You know, even ahead, but you can fill these men with all these artificial hormones to produce this weird secretion, and suddenly it's okay.
Yeah, yeah. No, it's And the funny thing is, I noticed when Leilani began talking about that, there was somebody a couple of people who laughed. And that's what most of us on the right did. Actually, Leilani taught me something fairly basic, because I just used to play it for laughs. I was thinking at one point of introducing a bad tranny of the week feature.
You can't say tranny either anymore.
No, on the show, but there's because these people aren't even making an effort. And actually, Leilani taught me something which I think is true, is it's not just wacky and weird and funny and goofy. It's actually evil what they're doing to hundreds of thousands of middle school girls across America and other countries in the world. It is evil.
It's awful, yeah.
You did a whole series on this for us, Tal. You looked into the sort of background. Are you surprised at the way something entirely fringe for thousands of years suddenly went mainstream?
Hi, thanks for having me on the panel. Yeah, these are big questions. I mean, modesty forbids me from answering that question, honestly. I guess I did, because I don't even know where to begin. I mean, as anyone who tried to follow that rambling series that I was, you so generously allowed me to run with for a while anyway, there is something built in to liberal societies, which includes all of the West. Mm. I don't mean sort of whatever Nancy Pelosi is doing today when I say liberalism, but I just mean a kind of classically liberal society. There is some engine, I mean, as the name implies, of liberation. Like, there is something sewn into the DNA of the liberal society that values liberation from any constraint, from anything unchosen, just in and of itself. That there is something righteous about liberating oneself from potentially anything. And so now we've come to biological sex. Literally every cell in your body is a male cell or a female cell, right? And that's just, it wasn't chosen. Therefore, there's something inhibiting about that. Therefore, there's something wrong about that, cosmically wrong. And so it becomes a kind of symbol of one's autonomy, of one's power, of one's sort of righteousness, like self-actualization, to be able to transcend one's own self. Mm. So there is this kind of strange, perverse, almost kind of spiritual, I don't know quite how to describe it, but it is just this engine of endless liberation. And I don't really know, I mean, I guess I was going to say I don't know how to stop it, but let me just throw a couple other things out really quick. Is, you know, it's not just that we've lost the cultural battle and we lose it every single day in 1,000 different ways. It's that we've lost the power battle, the political power battle. And we don't, like, and to begin with, we don't really have an alternative, compelling vision that is rooted in anything, you know, persuasive, right. If that makes sense, yeah. Right? And I think one of the reasons that it's not really persuasive is precisely because we're in liberal societies where the ultimate arbiter of what you should be able to do or not is, at least ostensibly, is reason. And it's very difficult to win some of these arguments with reason alone. Like, we're talking about how it's evil. Like, how do you make an argument for evil through reason alone? So when we even declare something inherently good or evil, we're actually invoking some sort of spiritual or intuitional, intuitive type feeling. So,
well, you're right that the left's great advantage is they essentially present all these revolutionary and concepts within the framework mostly of the American racial paradigm. So it seems like a civil rights issue. Oh, where is the harm? This poor man would like to be a woman. Where is the harm in denying him the right to do that? But when, as Leilani said, you're actually making little girls infertile, the ability to, you can't reverse the damage that is done when you do these things.
And there's 13-year-old girls having mastectomies.
Yes.
I mean, this is real, and this is actually happening in America. And, you know, they can say it's rare, but one or two is too many.
No, that's true. And the fact is that it is everywhere. When I've been around the theater most of my life, so I'm sort of not surprised by a lot of this stuff, and I've known what we used to call transsexuals when they were one in 30 million people. But it's everywhere. I flew down to Fort Lauderdale to get on the ship, and at the airport, one of the ladies who sort of assisted me was actually an extremely unconvincing transgender, and at the local, and at the there's a pharmacy that where every so often I go and collect my pills, and the person there is gender fluid, just going back and forth. I can't even tell now what he or she was originally, because he or she doesn't make a convincing man or woman either way. And the whole point here is the boundless ambition of the left, Samantha, because to abolish human biology, and the idea being that somehow once we have destroyed the basic building blocks of society, men and women, children, family, we can build utopia in the rubble. That's how they think of it.
Exactly, and it's coming from an inherent place of privilege, I find, because the West, arguably, we have no issues. We have equality in race, we have equality in gender, we have flourishing, or well, once flourishing economies. we That's are... True. benefiting of all of the privileges that the West can offer. And so the left, in their inherent victimhood, must find the next building block to claim that they are oppressed and that they are victimized and that they have suffered some great injustice. And in a society where transgender people are so oppressed, so to speak, well, they certainly spend a lot of time on social media freely bragging about how oppressed they are and being met with raucous applause and affirmation.
So yeah, no, I don't get that. If I was an oppressed woman, so-called, I wouldn't sort of deal with it by going into the ladies' changing room and swinging my meat and two veg around, which is what these oppressed women seem to be doing. And the funny and the thing about it is there are no it's not just what is that phrase Al Gore used to use? Oh, taking their place at the American table. There's a limited number of places at the table, and so if you raise up a new identity group, then you diminish an existing one. And in this case, women, it seems to me, are just being totally screwed over by this new trend.
Absolutely. And, you know, when I won Miss Great Britain, the whole world opened up for me, basically. Mm. And, you know, it was how I was able to get over to America and get a visa. But now you have men winning that, taking that from, stealing it from women. You have women and men stealing from women's sports, taking their prize money, taking their trophies, taking the names off their, you know, the plaques and the leaderboards. And by saying, you know, well, let's just be so liberal and invite everybody in, you are actually diminishing women as well, and you're taking away from us and stealing from us, actually.
But the funny thing, you're right, there's stealing from real women, but the funny thing is most women put up with it. You were one of the first to write. It was actually in my states, a few hours south of me, I think it was Derry or Londonderry, New Hampshire, where the first trans, it's part of the Miss New Hampshire, part of the Miss America pageant, the first trans person in Miss America. And you think, oh, great, maybe this is one of those nice, cute, girly trans stuff. No, it was like this big, incredible Hulk-sized figure in an ill-fitting dress and a bad wig. And she's standing there in the Miss New Hampshire finals, this great big, you know, it's not one of these, spot the tranny. This is going to take us ages to work this out. There's like all these nice, demure, all-American high school girls around this big, and she's, he's, well, I say she's, the name was Brian, but she pronounces it Brianne. And so, and basically, I mean, this is what's sick about it, is that the whole racket is they're daring you to call them on it, and nobody does.
And I think, again, it's people being afraid that in the future they're going to be called transphobic. Mm. And I know that that's what happened with Riley Gaines, is that she didn't speak out for a minute and her teammates didn't because they were so afraid of being called transphobic for the rest of their lives and after college it affecting their jobs and what have you. You know, obviously Riley Gaines has gone on to speak against it very vocally, but that's almost like her job now to speak about it. So I think there is this kind of fear about speaking the truth. And like I've said with you, Mark, it's like, if you don't agree with the narrative and you're not afraid of the narrative, they want you to be afraid of speaking against it or standing against it, and they will go after you through lawfare, they will go after your jobs, and I think the only way to combat it is to, you know, be able to come to places like this and speak amongst yourselves and in groups and make new, you know, make a community almost of people where you can speak freely and become friends and have a support group and realize you're not the only person that feels this way.
Well, here's one thing that bothers me, Tal, because I think about these little girls and these horrible websites. You go to any middle school now. I'm so glad my My own kids were sort of about a year or two ahead of when this kicked in. Because I certainly, my kids are a big enough problem with the sex assigned at birth. I certainly wouldn't want to have to start dealing with them if they were switching every couple of months or whatever. But I start thinking about this, and you know, I listen to what our enemies say. And you can say what you like about Chairman Xi in China, or Vladimir Putin in the Kremlin, or the mullahs in Tehran, but all of those guys know what a woman is. And the Supreme Court judges in the United States, as Leilani was saying, I take it in some way they know what a woman is, but they don't feel confident enough to say it in a Senate nomination hearing. The leader of the Labour Party in London doesn't feel confident enough to say what a woman is. And public health officials in Australia don't feel confident enough to say what a woman is. I mean, you know, Putin and Chairman Xi and the mullahs, they don't have that problem, Tal. Well,
and what do they all have in common? These are populations that upon which Enlightenment liberalism didn't really have all that much effect. So they bypassed... Hmm. Right, they're kind of on a parallel track in their own different ways. Right, they're sort of so. If you're in a let's just take a Chinese mindset. It's perfectly valid for you to justify your position based on tradition. Like, here's an example of the kind of different mindset I'm talking about. Tucker Carlson goes and interviews Vladimir Putin. Asks him one question, the guy gives a 35-minute history lecture that spans 1,000 years. So, right. Like, Tucker is sitting there, like, what is this guy talking about? Everyone in the West has no idea what this guy's talking about. It makes no sense. And what do you instantly think? You think he's bluffing. You think he's stalling for time. He's not stalling for time. No. That's what people outside of Western cultures are like. They have a very different sense of time. They also have a very different sense of what makes something valid. Yeah. Right? So making an argument based on history or tradition, that's something that we don't really have in the West. And it's, you know, for whatever kind of good things we might say about that, there's this kind of offsetting vulnerability where, again, you kind of come back to those questions like, who's going to win the rational argument about, you know, trans women entering something or other and the board said it was okay? And I mean, how do you win that argument without invoking, like I said, non-rational things? I don't know that you can.
Well, that's really the other side of the equation, isn't it? One reason why nobody knows who they are anymore is because the entirety of our civilizational inheritance has been abolished until the day before yesterday. So when you do what we're doing, you know, oh, we can't talk about that guy because his great-great-great-great-grandfather was co-owner of a plantation in Antigua in the 17th century, and we can't talk about this guy, and we can't talk about those. Then you're completely unmoored. You're basically just floating around in the present tense and vulnerable to anything, Samantha.
Absolutely. And I think there's an interesting dichotomy as well, because, you know, we say that that you're not able to invoke tradition or cultural heritage. Mm. You are, so long as you're not white. As long as you're not white, you can rest on your religion or your cultural inheritance. You can rest on your laurels in any means to justify whatever nonsensical belief you may have, whether it's, you know, that you believe that women shouldn't have the right to vote, or whether you believe that Larry should be able to become Lucy. You can say that, oh no, but it's part of my religious beliefs. As long as those beliefs aren't Christian, as long as your cultural heritage isn't white British or white American. And I think that there's a very sad loss, as you said, of the cultural heritage of the forefathers of these founding nations, in that it's only used when it can be weaponized against white people to tear them down. You know, your father's 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 father was a slave owner, so therefore you have no place at Al Gore's table anymore.
Right.
If the sins of your forefathers are to be borne by us in the 21st century, then nobody is perfect. Nobody's safe, and we start at ground zero again. So why is there this unequal opportunity when it comes to the hierarchy of victimhood and the hierarchy of racial politics or religious identity that means that it's always white, Christian, usually men that are at the bottom of that ladder? Why are we denying them their agency? If this was a conversation that was being had about the denial of agency and rights and a place at the table for Muslim people or for Asian people or whatever, then everyone would be up in arms. So why is it only white people that are denied that voice?
That's basically the elephant in the room, is that certain groups just get to be themselves. No one actually goes to the local mosque and says, you guys need to stop being so uptight about gays, because they know they're going to be having to scram out. So those groups can have their identity. And, you know, to be crude about it, the one group that is denied its identity is white people, which is why when you go to schools across America and the rest of the English-speaking world, white people, if you're being denigrated from kindergarten, if you're being told you got privilege, you're supremacist, you're responsible for all the evils of the world, why wouldn't you decide, okay, I'm going to get out, I'm going to change and become something other? I mean, how long do you think white men in particular, Tal, are gonna put up with being denied the only group to have an identity?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I don't meet white guys that feel like they're on a big white man team. I mean, I don't really feel that way. You know, I don't feel that way. I mean, I've lived in Argentina. I've been all over the world. Yeah. And I resonate more with, you know, people as individuals and, you know, their cultural affinities or whatever. You know, I don't know. I mean, as you imply, it's kind of heading in that direction because, you know, if you don't, then you're kind of hooped, right? You know, you're kind of screwed. Yeah. But who really wants to see, I'm on team white man. I'd rather be with good people. I don't really care what color they are. I'm just speaking as an individual, you know, but I don't know.
I don't like to think of it like that either, but when everybody is telling you that certain characteristics are the defining aspect of you, then the logic is to push people down that route, don't you think?
Well, I actually look at it the other way. I see what they're telling black kids or, you know, Asian kids or non-white kids, that they're victims and that they're oppressed. And when you tell a child that, that is what will be in the mindset of the child as that child grows. Now, my mum's from the Philippines, and there was never a second where she ever put in my head that I couldn't do anything that I wanted to do. And, you know, when I think back to little words or phrases I remember from my godparents or my aunties, they were all very positive affirmations. So to put that through critical race theory into, you know, minority kids' heads, I think is very dangerous for them as well. And it's almost like being part of the Ku Klux Klan from these lefties, where they're saying, white people, we're the dominant ones, you are oppressed, this is it. Yeah. And it's almost come full circle where they're doing that to these children. And putting that into their heads.
Yeah, and when you say these guys are the Ku Klux Klan, it's like all the old racial classifications of race. I was in a Vermont hospital, not a terribly satisfactory experience. And while I was there, they were doing one of these stupid forms that you have to give the answers to. And so the nurse asked me what my preferred identity was. And she had like 57 of them, and she started to read it, the list. I said, do you have Canadian on there? And she said, no, we don't have that one. And I said, oh, that, in that case, you don't have one for me there. And the sheer stupidity of this is breaking down. I mean, Samantha talks a lot about common sense, but common sense presumes that a society has something in common. And in the end, when you do this, does the nice she gay couple at 27 Elm Street have anything in common with the fire-breathing imam and his four child brides at 25 Elm Street? I mean, if you don't have anything in common, common sense is one of the first casualties, Samantha.
Absolutely, and it's... I think that all of the progressive figures that the left look up to, you know, Martin Luther King, judged not by the color of my skin, but by the content of my character, he would be rolling in his grave if he saw the state of critical race theory and modern American politics. We are allowing the creation of these very insular sects of society who aren't expected to integrate with the wider communities, who aren't expected to make any real effort to find commonality and common ground amongst their brothers and sisters in their neighborhoods. Yeah. They are allowed to exist in this very narrow-minded and very insular state of existence. And if anyone dares to question that, then no, you're Islamophobic or you're racist or you're transphobic or you're homophobic. God, there's so many phobias. You must spend your entire life afraid if you have any common sense.
No, I'm phobia-phobic. I can't stand any of this. Is it, here's the question that I always find interesting from going around the continent, is this stuff started in America, Tal, and then those other Anglo nations that mimic America in its cultural fashions, such as Britain, Canada, Australia, they took it up. But if you go to, like, France, they regard le wokisme, as they call it, as an existential threat. And that's there's not a lot of enthusiasm for it in France. There's not a lot of enthusiasm for it in Switzerland. And as you go further east in Europe, they're downright hostile to it. Is this basically an American situation?
Well, yeah. America was the spawning ground. I think that those other populations are more resistant just because they're more ancient. So they actually, to be a Frenchman living in a French village where you're attending, you know, important religious services, where your great-great-great-great-great-great-grandfather attended them. And so, I think it's easier to think of yourself as just the latest point in a very long chain of people that inhabited that space, that culture, that language, and those general religious beliefs, even if you're lapsed. Even if you're a lapsed Catholic, you're still kind of a Catholic by identity. So I think it's easier for those more ancient cultures to just say, okay, this isn't who we are. But, when you talk about the Anglosphere, at least the, America, Australia, New Zealand, we're talking about fairly new cultures that there was very little emphasis on kind of ethnic affiliation. It was a kind of come one, come all, as long as you meet these particular standards, and we're taking people from all over the world. So it was a truly liberal kind of social contract idea founding these countries, right? So, they don't have the kind of chronological root system that these other cultures have.
Yeah, but even that idea has, so that everyone now, America, nation of immigrants, which I don't think is actually true. I think I said somewhere or other, the French gave the Americans the statue, a great Statue of Liberty, and the Americans wrecked it by turning it into a statue of mass immigration, which is not what the idea of it was. But again, that too is an identity group issue, because the most fundamental one in a way, because if you have mass immigration on the scale that almost every Western nation does now. I mean, Trump had a great line when, you remember when he dismissed all these countries, why do we get all these people from what he called bleep hole countries? And he said, why don't we get anybody from Norway? Well, you know, Norway's only got 5 million people. And so if the entire population of Norway moved to the United States, that would be less. That would be something like, on the official figures, you know, maybe two-thirds of the number of people who've just walked across the border while Joe Biden has been in charge of immigration policy. So you're confronted by the idea, you get the idea that all this sort of trans stuff and all the rest of it is only an intermediate stage, and that's what's the real identity groups, the people just walking across the Rio Grande or landing on the southern shore of England every night, that they represent something real in a way that all these sort of boutique obsessions are just a sort of interregnum, Samantha.
Definitely. You know, the phrase "fiddling while Rome burns" is very true to this, I would say. That while we are so het up about transgenderism and gender fluidity and all of these identity issues within our own insular culture, we have a great mass import of foreign cultures that are, as you said, just walking straight across the border and are able to populate and colonize our lands without any real opposition. You know, for example, Germany has was always touted by the left as a beacon of tolerance, which is quite, you know, really it is quite ironic, really, if you think about the history of that nation. But they had an open borders policy for years, and now the president of Germany has come out and admit that when we have 350,000 immigrants seeking asylum every year in our nation, we're at breaking point, and they're now having to plan mass deportations because they realize that the existential threat of these imported cultures and imported communities that have no intention of integrating or becoming part of the nations that they're moving to and have any real reasons to be in the country. You know, many of these people aren't fleeing from war-torn countries. And this is what those that are branded racist right-wing bigots are often told. You know, you're persecuting refugees and asylum seekers. No, an economic migrant from Romania is not the same as a war-torn refugee fleeing from Syria. There's a very big difference. And yet we in the West are allowing this importation because we're so het up in our own insular communities, and we're so blind to the fact that this is occurring on a larger scale than any of us could really imagine.
Well, the numbers on these things. I mean, I just quoted these American statistics. You know, one reason why the left wants to abolish the Electoral College in America is because at that point, small states become totally irrelevant. So there's 500,000 people living in Wyoming. You know, if you've got 1 million people walking across the Rio Grande every 3 months, you know, Wyoming without the Electoral College isn't even an asterisk. Nobody cares about it. It's not going to matter. And the left understand that very clearly. But it's quite, you know, when Samantha says, they're not interested in assimilating, well, why would you, if you were, say, a Somali guy who comes to America, why would you be interested in assimilating if that means letting your son become your daughter? I mean, you have to have something to assimilate with that isn't nuts, and I'm not sure we have that. Now, I mean, in the UK, Leilani, it had the Albanian population of the UK in 2010 was 0.00002%. Now, 10% of the entire male population of Albania are living in the UK, and they come in as big strapping, they're very good at like organizing sex trafficking gangs and things like that, and they have no desire to become female beauty contestants, those Albanian men.
Well, what's scary about that is you know, you're not allowed to say that they haven't come from a war-torn country. There is no war in Albania. They're coming across. You know, I'm sure on EasyJet you could probably pay $100 to get across, but they would rather come through the channel because on a dinghy, because obviously they've got a lot to hide if they show their true identities. So we're really not importing the best people we can from these non-war-torn countries. And it's really scary when you see the amount of men that are coming through of fighting age. You have to question whether this is being done on purpose.
Yeah.
You know, because...
Yeah, how about the Chinese guys that are streaming into the United States through Mexico? Did you read about that?
No. Basically, everyone thinks it's people from Central America coming across the southern border. It's not. It's everyone from around the world, because they've all heard that's the easiest way to get in. If you miss the getting back on the ship when we land in Mexico, just go up to the northern border and walk in. Say you're from Sudan, and they'll give you a big. A cash envelope and put you up in a hotel. It's offensive.
But Mark, we talked about this before when I mentioned Serco, and Serco, the government take our money and give it to Serco, and Serco are meant to control the borders. They're also meant to control the prisons, but now they also have the most enormous government contracts to house these immigrants. So they're all on the take.
No, Serco is this UK company. It was headed by Rupert Soames, who's Winston Churchill's grandson. So we've gone from Winston Churchill, "We shall fight on the beaches," to his grandson, who welcomes the 1,000 Albanian men a night landing on the beaches and ushers them to these four-star country house hotels. He is the exclusive contractor. That guy also had the contract for the stupid waste of time COVID tests. You remember that? What they call track and trace? I mean, this guy has a fantastic business model because it's so versatile. When it comes to the COVID, it's track and trace. When it comes to open borders, it's no track, no trace.
Yeah.
And that's actually the world we're living in. You'll be tracked and traced within a millimeter of your lives, and there'll be this whole other alternative population that has the run of the planet. We're going to take some questions. I think Howard is... Is that Kathy or Pam?
Uh-huh.
Okay, and we'll take some questions there. If you've got any questions you would like to ask. If you don't have a question, feel free to sing selections from Les Miserables for a couple of minutes. Okay, this gentleman here.
Yes, I'd just like the erudite panel to address the issue of us losing the argument on empathy, as though we are a bunch of unempathetic, knuckle-dragging rubes that have no capacity for empathy, and that the left has hijacked the empathy argument.
Yeah, that's a point you touched on, Tal, that which I don't quite understand why the caring side is to slice the breasts off middle school girls and make them infertile, but somehow if you're opposed to that, you're the uncaring, unempathetic guy.
Yeah, I mean, on that point, I mean, empathy would be to sit down with an adolescent struggling with identity and seeking purpose and meaning and belonging and help them through that difficult time, not telling them, when it all boils down to it, that they're a cosmic mistake. Because that's what it is when you say to that young 15-year-old boy or girl who doesn't really know who they are in that moment and is surrounded by 1,000 messages all around and went onto Instagram and found all of these great places where he knows he will receive validation, a sense of esteem from peers if he just comes out as a woman. That's not empathy.
No.
I mean, that's the opposite of empathy. And I mean, it's really insidious too. Like, you know, the amount of parents that will exploit that moment to showboat what great parents, how tolerant and how empathetic they are.
Well, well,
I'm the proud mom or dad of a trans thing, and the kid's like 11.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think there's a difference, though, because it's, I've noticed that in Hollywood, for example, that having a trans kid has become like the latest boutique accessory.
Yeah. If you're, yeah, like the teacup chihuahua was replaced by the trans child.
Yeah. And it's like fantastic. If you're Jamie Lee Curtis or Warren Beatty or whatever, I can you probably got enough dough to be able to cruise through that. I think when it comes to just some, you know, just a mom and dad living in northern Maine or whatever, and they're told they have to get with the program, I think they're just really being bullied into it, actually.
I think parents aren't allowed to be parents anymore. They're told by society that, oh, if you care for your child, you'll affirm whatever it is they say. Children know best. Children don't know best. I've barely finished being a child myself, and I know that I certainly didn't know what was best when I was 14, 15 years old. The idea that caring now equals validating mental illness is just bizarre to me. You know, if I had told my little immigrant mother that I wanted to change my name to Samuel, then she would have said, well, become a doctor first, and then you can talk to me. You know, find some sort of success. That was the idea of caring and of empathy for parents of our parents' generation. Was, we want you to be successful. We want you to build a life of your own, and everything that comes on the fringe of that, whether you want to, you know, be gay or bi or whatever, that's your business. But we care about the things that will impact your life in a meaningful way and will build towards your success. Whereas now, parents are being told that if they aren't accepting everything that their child is being fed from social media, because that's what it is, it's social media, it's the left, it's this toxic ideology that is imprinting itself on vulnerable, impressionable children, that parents are now being told, well, you have to affirm this or you don't care about your child, you're a bad parent.
Yeah. And they'll actually take the child away, which has been done before, and, you know, very recently, the courts have ordered the children to be put into foster care because their parents won't affirm them or call them by the pronouns they want to be called by.
Yep, which is that you'll lose your child if you resist it. Let's take another question. I think we have a lady coming towards us.
Rosemary Peters from Auburn, California. I like the fact that you're addressing the chemical castration,
right,
and the chemical infusion in the body. But I wish we'd go deeper than that. I know when I was born, my mother was on a drug, diosilbestrol, we still use, which made me infertile. And that was, 72 years ago. I know this is going to be a pushback to a lot of women, but birth control pills, when you take them, infuses into your eggs, which are born with your finite eggs. Everybody knows that, correct? And drugs go into every cell of your body. So when you're putting estrogen into your body through birth control pills, it will affect your eggs. And when you get pregnant, my theory, being medical, is you now have more female in you, even though you're going to be a boy. And I believe, you have a child that is now more effeminate. You following my drift?
Yeah.
Yeah,
I don't think we do enough investigation with this because birth control pill came in the 60s. And if you look at the trends, go ahead.
No, I don't know, but certainly, I don't know about causation, but certainly there is correlation, because since for the last 60 years or so, there's been declining sperm counts in men throughout the West. So that you are correct if in your general position that men are less manly than they were 30, 40, 50 years ago. That is a general truth. Nobody knows why it is. It's not talked about. Because, but the declining sperm count is a phenomenon in America, Canada, Britain. I wrote about this once, because the only story that came up about it was a story out of Sweden when lesbians who wanted to be artificially inseminated started complaining about the low quality of male sperm. That's the only way this story even makes the paper, is when you've got these broody lesbians whose lives are completely wrecked by this crappy old straight male sperm that is no longer any good.
Very weak men.
Yeah, yes. Yeah. So you you wanted to say something.
Yeah,
about
and that. I've also read that it is actually washing out of women and going into obviously the water cycle and the water supply. You've also got, you know, Alex Jones said it. Atrazine. There's a pesticide that goes into the water supply that's turning frogs into females. Yeah.
They all said he was crazy when he said that, and I think part of it is his delivery, right? But there is something to that.
Yeah,
that's actually a real thing.
And these, like, they're hormone mimickers. They mimic estrogen. They mimic these hormones, and they go into the water supply.
You can laugh, but remember this. Because in 20 years' time, when you're living in a dictatorship run by transgender frogs, you will remember this. But just on the broader point here, Tal, Robert F. Kennedy Jr. said this to me. He was the first guy to say this to me. He said, Americans are the most medicated people on Earth, and they get the worst health outcomes. And I thought about it, and he was talking about when his kids were in school, and I remember my kids were just in a grade school in New Hampshire, and the urge to medicate the kids was incredible. I remember being in Australia, and they wanted to put my kid, because he'd had a bit of a tantrum in grade two or whatever, they wanted to put him on, you know, personality-altering drugs. And I said, I was ready to fly back, put him in the car and drive him out of the country over that. Because we didn't, when I was at school, which is certainly before, I think everyone on this panel, but you know, we had a matron, as she was called, that we used to go and see when you felt, if you'd broken your leg or something. She just made you go behind the screen and take your clothes off, and then she'd examine you to see that nothing was wrong, and then she'd send you out again. But the idea of putting you on personality-altering drugs...
I had some personality-altering in myself growing up in small-town Washington, and it was called a wooden paddle on my butt. It was still legal in those days. And it's not legal anymore. But, you know, it's funny. I mean, all jokes aside, I'm not exaggerating when I say this. Not 10 or 20. One smack from Mr. Koberstad on my butt. I was 12 and I was unruly. I actually tried to spit on his wife, who was a yard manager. That's how bad I was. I was on the second floor and saw his horrible, mean wife out the yard monitor, and I was trying to show off for the girls. That hasn't changed. But
I have to take the paddle to tell if you keep.
And somebody saw me, and her husband, who was the vice principal, came up and smacked me. I mean, lifted me off the ground with this whack. And they all had handcrafted wooden paddles, right? They'd go into the workshop, each male teacher.
No.
I mean, that actually changed my personality. It actually, like, wrought a physiological change. I mean, talk about a chemical change. Like, my brain was never able to even contemplate doing anything like that ever again. And it only took a second.
It was good. I like the way the masters at my school, when they took the cane to you. There was one of them who always used to say, he was always disappointed that he had to beat me. And he always used to say, this is going to hurt me far more than it hurts you, which wasn't in the least bit true. Let's have this lady here.
I'm Marion Fuller from the Free State of Florida.
Oh. Yeah.
And I wanted to thank Mark for this opportunity. Thank you so much. But I do have a question. We talk about empathy and support groups always being organized around groups, victimized groups. I wonder if there's any other people in this audience besides just my husband and myself who could use a support group to try to regain the love and respect and support of family members and friends that we have lost because we have been shunned and canceled to express our opinion, which to us makes a lot of common sense.
Yeah, you're right. We always have a lot of Californians on these cruises, and they basically talk about how they 7 days a week they have to just zip it. They can't say anything they think, and they love just being able to come on this cruise and just being able to have a normal conversation without worrying about whether this will get them cancelled or cost them their job or whatever. Because it's like you hear about the showbiz guys who get cancelled, but you don't hear about somebody who's just like serving on a school board in Michigan and just happens to say the wrong thing and gets booted off the school board and all the rest of it. In a way, this is. There's no popular mandate driving the conversion of large numbers of girls into boys and vice versa. There's no popular mandate saying, 9/11 happened. The rational response to 9/11 is to double the rate of Muslim immigration to the West, which is what happened. There's no popular mandate, and yet because elite people are in favor of these things, they seem able to cow the masses into silence on it. Samantha?
And it started with the vaccines. It was a method of population control that cowed people into silence and suppressed their right to free speech. You know, in 2020, I think that was really the beginning of the end of free speech outside of left-wing circles, because those who expressed any, and it isn't even saying that, you know, vaccines are made by Bill Gates to track you. It wasn't even that. It was just genuine, ordinary, rational thinking people who expressed their dissatisfaction or their concern over the implementation of a mass vaccine program on everyone from out of the womb until age 105 that, you know, hadn't been properly tested, hadn't gone through the rigorous checks that ordinarily would. And they were branded extremists. They were told, well, you're not caring for your brother and sister. You want your granny to die in a hospital on a ventilator. Well, and now, you know, that idea that you can control the opinions and the thought of the masses by cancelling any dissidents has pervaded every social issue, and you're made to feel as though you are the problem. You're an outsider. You are the uneducated woman. If you look across this room, I think I've heard more PhDs and medical qualifications here than I have from any left-wing talk show, and you're told that you are somehow an anti-progress, when really all you're doing is expressing an alternative view to what the elites and the masses want to have you believe.
Well, Leilani, I think you were more or less actually among the first three or four to, because you intuited in a way that actually nobody in the media at that time did, that a vaccine that you, as Samantha said, you pump into everyone from a newborn baby to a 106-year-old guy. For every single person on the planet, you just stick it in them, whatever. This was a development that prudent persons should be wary of.
Yeah, I think that I definitely said it when it came out, because I just felt that the lockdowns were a push towards it, and I knew that they would then say you can only get out of the lockdowns if you have this. I just felt from the beginning of lockdowns that was what was going to come. What I find the most scary is they're still having mandates in some of the big Ivy League universities in America, which says to me is that anybody who will stand up against a narrative isn't going to be allowed into that university. So who are the new generation of doctors going to be? They're going to be people that will go along with the narrative, as will the new, you know, the next set of lawyers and the new generation of lawyers. And anyone important in society are going to have to be people that will go along with the narrative and not stand up. But I do think it's come a lot before that, because you went against the climate change narrative 12 years ago, and look what's happened to you. You cannot stand up against these people. They want to silence anyone that speaks up against any kind of narrative that they're trying to push.
Well, that's the old Soviet who whom thing, is that basically people don't believe in free speech. Instead, they think people under, name your cutoff point, people under 40, 50, 67, whatever, increasingly think there are correct answers to the climate, to mass immigration, to lockdowns. And it astonishes me, just flying down to Fort Lauderdale, the number of masked people I saw on the plane, at the airports, these people are poisoning themselves. They're wearing these crappy Chinese-made masks, breathing in these little bits of chemical particles, and they think somehow that and that's what's so weird about that, is that's basically the identity group that matters. Is the percentage of the population who are compliant, who will be told stupid things. Oh, you can't have your granny over for Thanksgiving. Why not? Oh, because of the COVID. Well, wait a minute, is it really that I can't invite my family members to my own house? Oh yeah, that makes a lot of sense. A society built on the principle that you can't invite your own family members to your own house, that seems likely to be an agreeable free society in which we'll all enjoy living. Let's have, we've got a lady here who's got a question, I think.
Good morning. Since all of this tranny, homo, communist nonsense is unsustainable, do you not think we should just mock and jeer and point and laugh as much as possible so that it self-destructs all the faster?
I used to believe that mocking and hooting and jeering would be enough. I mean, I loved it in when they had what was it called, the Chop Zone? It was a sort of autonomous republic, and I think it was Portland for a while. And you'd be wherever it was, you'd be like just strolling down the street. I noticed that. It was like psycho trannies. a lot of them were, because the interesting thing is that a lot of them are from these white upper middle class backgrounds where for some reason they become immensely dissatisfied. So you'd be just like strolling down the street and out of nowhere, some like 240-pound psycho tranny would come charging around the corner and bulldoze you to the ground. And I thought it would be enough to... But nobody... The problem with the laughing theory is that nobody who matters in our society is laughing. Not the politicians, not the judges, not the doctors, not the school teachers.
Well, I was going to say... I mean, there are... important, if not altogether exposed, elements from government that are pushing all of this. Okay? So it's not like this is a purely bottom-up sort of freakazoidal faddish thing, although it is that to some extent, maybe. But no, I mean, when you have state legislatures and, of course, a whole raft of federal policies that are promoting and rewarding, financially rewarding, gigantic corporations for going along with diversity, equity, inclusion things. I mean, they're getting tax breaks. It's the same thing with that piece I wrote on your website about washing machines, right? I mean, the federal government's like financially rewarded the abolition of the washing machine.
Yep.
Okay, and they do that, like, you know, I mean, they just get worse and worse and more expensive. But it's not just washing machines, of course. It's like it's all of this stuff too.
Yep.
So that's another point where it kind of laughing alone is not enough. Like there is some point, I think, where people that know in their bones that there is something absolutely abusive about taking the 14-year-old boy and convincing him or applauding when he says, I think I might be a girl, and ruining that child's fertility forever and honestly his life. I mean, the suicide rates are astronomical. I mean, it's lifetimes of misery. It's just absolutely heartbreaking. Heartbreaking. at some point, we're going to have to face the reality that there is a power game afoot here. And to simply say, well, you know, as we've discussed before, well, politics is always downstream from culture, so let's just make a, you know, a movie. That, you know, that's not enough, and that's not how they beat us. They beat us because they cover everything. It's like multiple fronts.
Yeah, no, that's my line that I started using, whatever it was, I think in the first year of the Bush administration, when the left wins, it's in power. When the right wins, it's in office. And then they, you know, so they take over. It reminded me of, because we're all doing school anecdotes today, but it reminded me of boys in chilly, frosty English boarding schools. The prefects, the senior boys, used to pay one of the junior boys, because the toilet seats were very cold. And so they'd pay one of the junior boys to go and sit on the toilet seat and just warm it up for 10 minutes until they were ready to take their place. And when the right is in power, they often remind me of the toilet seat warmers until the left takes over. Do we have a question here? Oh, yes, we have a question. This is, by the way, this is my old friend Dan Colson, who used to run the Telegraph Group in London back when it was a readable newspaper. I am tired of the UK people saying to me, what's happened to the Telegraph? What's happened to the Telegraph is that guy no longer runs it, and a lot of pansy types who aren't serious about newspapering do it. What's your question, Dan?
Mark, my question is this. Like you and most people in this room, I'm sure, I'm very worried about the whole transgender situation. But I'm particularly annoyed and very concerned, and frankly, don't understand the attitude of sports bodies to transgenderism in sports. Whether it's a high school athlete or a college athlete, every week you invariably read an article in the press about some horrible incident involving some 13-year-old girl playing basketball against some guy who's, you know, learning how to shave.
Yeah.
And should be, and as you said earlier, you've got these guys on swimming teams changing 3 and 4 times a day in dressing rooms, complete with their, as you called it, meat and 2 veg.
Right.
And it's just incomprehensible to me that this is allowed to happen. And it's getting worse. I mean, pretty soon they even had it in the last Olympics, as you know, they had a so-called female weightlifter who was a guy.
Right. But the example you mentioned, I mean, basically, we're applauding, girls are being beaten up by blokes. They're having the crap beaten out of them in these, they're being physically beat, these are guys who are beating up girls and being given a medal for it.
Yes. And you know, what motivation does that give your daughters or your granddaughters to go and spend every moment training, working as hard as they can, hard as they can to try and win in a race, knowing that, you know, a few seconds matters for this 6'4" guy to just come in and, you know, take everything. You know, seconds matter, milliseconds matter.
Yeah.
And how, I just don't understand how you can give your kids, your girls, that motivation to do it when they just think, well, you know, what's the point? A biological guy is going to come in and that's it. That's all my years of training and dedication and eating well and working out. It's all gone. It's all gone down the pan.
No, there'll be no. Let's take one more question from the lady just here. We'll have as our final question.
So I want to thank all of you on stage for doing what you do individually to fight this. And I just want to say that. The thing is, I've heard many times from people that, you know, what can I do as an ordinary person, and I don't have any power to do something. And something that happened in the past year really surprised me, which was Bud Light.
Right.
I think that was a moment where people could demarcate an issue, they did feel strongly about it, and they did something. And I think that caught global power and corporate America, corporate everybody, really by surprise. And I don't think Bud Light has recovered.
No, if for those who aren't American, Bud Light, well, for start, if you're not American, don't go anywhere near Bud Light, believe me. In fact, it's disgraceful that it took the whole transgender thing to kill Bud Light, as opposed to the taste of Bud Light. This was where you mentioned him, her, whatever, Dylan Mulvaney, who did this. They decided that beer drinkers are natural tranny lovers. This is if you go to the sports bar out by the grain elevator on Route 137, all the guys in there basically are unsure what beer they want to drink until some transgender endorses it. Because that's blokes, so there's so much male insecurity around now. And basically, when they got that, there was such a pushback, it tanked that stock. It destroyed that stock. You were very strong on this at that time, Leila.
Well, I think the thing is they want you to think that we have no power. Mm. And they want you to think that if you don't have a big Twitter profile or if you're not on TV, there's nothing you can do. But when you are able to just speak up, you know, in person to people, come to things like this, meet everyone else, you know, exchange details, keep in touch, and then share your contacts. And, you know, I've built group. Mentioned Los Angeles. I put all of my like-minded friends who were afraid to say anything together in a WhatsApp group. And now there's like 100 girls in there all chatting about, you know, everything. And they feel so much more empowered because they want you to think that, you know, we're the only ones that feel this way. And that's why, you know, they try and censor the people that do speak out. But when you can have private conversations with people and kind of build communities, make sure you know who your children's friends are, your grandchildren's friends are, your nieces and nephews' friends are, and who their parents are and what their parents' kinds of thoughts are, and then you're prepared to deprogram them from what they're learning at school and their peers. That's how you're going to, you know, get through this and find solutions.
You can also do what Leilani did and just shove it down their gullets, because Leilani has a pinned tweet on her Twitter feed that shows Leilani in a bathing costume next to Dylan Mulvaney in a bathing costume, and underneath the picture of Leilani is a picture of Leilani's horse. And under the picture of Dylan Mulvaney is a picture of a pantomime horse. although it's a pantomime horse with two rear ends in his case, I think. So you can always do things like that. But I go back to what that lady was saying, that in the end, you know, she says, why don't we just let it have a laugh while this thing burns itself out? Because the people, as you know, Samantha, from what happened in Telford for decades, that there are still real raw identities out there, like all those child rape gangs all over England, and the ones coming in, and you know, it's amazing to me when the Albanian guys come in, they're put up in the Country House Hotel, and 3 days later you see them hanging around the schoolyard gates. Eventually, something real beats something phony.
Absolutely, and we always talk about action and impacting change as on a global scale. So for example, tanking the Bud Light stocks or convincing World Cycling to stop letting transgenders race women in women's cycling events. But on a smaller scale in towns like Telford, there is a revolution going on, and this is happening across the country, across the UK, the US, Canada, Australia, where ordinary people who don't necessarily have the big Twitter profile or the agency to be able to go on national news and scream and shout as we do about political issues, they are saying enough is enough. They are identifying, you all are identifying the threats to ordinary society, and it's a collective action, a collective voice is far stronger than one singular person on a TV show interview. I think that, you know, Telford, everything that has come out about the child sexual exploitation scandals and Pakistani Muslim grooming gangs, wouldn't have happened were it not for ordinary people to do what those in power, those in position, the elites, failed to do for decades. It's where governments fail, where politicians fail, where celebrities fail, it takes ordinary people to take up the gauntlet and fight on behalf of those who don't have a voice.
Yeah, and actually that's an important point, because you can wait. The thing about the Bud Light thing is that'll come along once in a while. But every day this stuff, in towns nobody's heard of, this stuff is happening. At little, you know, middle schools nobody's heard of, this stuff is happening. And the thing about it is, don't put up with it. Don't go to a school board meeting and listen to this nonsense and decide you're just gonna keep silent or whatever. Yeah, boycott all the, is they the ones with the tucking pouches in the swimsuit so that Dylan Mulvaney can look a little more convincing when he's wearing his mini kini. I don't want that, actually, because I don't want to discover the tucking secret at the last minute. I'd rather it was like more out. So you're quite right. Don't support because This is beyond anything in the fall of Rome. The rise of the bee-penist woman is actually is a more stupid form of civilizational suicide than has ever been devised. And you're not going to get cowardly politicians like Nikki Haley to come out against it. She's finger in the windy. She's poll tested. And you're not going to get some poll-tested, risk-averse politician. I think it's nice. I might get a tucking pouch from Target. They've got a great buy one, get one free offer there now. Don't go along with it. The most important lesson is to live in truth and not accept the lies. I want to thank my fantastic guests, Samantha Smith, Tal Bachman and Leilani Dowding. And I tell you what, next time we have Leilani on, we're going to get her to bring her horse, and we'll have Dylan Mulvaney bring his pantomime horse too, and you can judge for yourself. Thank you very much. We will see you next time.
Join us next time for another edition of The Mark Stein Show. The Mark Stein Show is a production of Mark Stein Enterprises and Oak Hill Media. All rights reserved.